Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 20 of What's It Like? My guest is Will Harris, who is in London. How are you doing, Will?
I'm very well, thank you, and thanks so much for having me.
So did you grow up in London?
I didn't. I actually grew up in a place called Hereford, which is on the border with Wales, on the sort of, in sort of west of Britain. And I moved to Oxford when I went to university there at 18, stayed there after university. And I still live in Oxfordshire, but I work in London because I work in media, and basically everything in media in England is in London.
Aha. Uh-huh. I'm not too familiar with the British educational system, but you went for your exams, and then you went...
Yeah, my undergraduate degree, yeah. So in England, you have high school and sixth form, which is, you know, kind of like high school in the States. And then you have university, which is like going to college. And then after university, it's on to whatever job or professional qualification you want to do.
But in university, you went for law.
I did. I read law because I thought when I was at university, I wanted to be a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
And I actually...
You did the three-year program?
Yeah, so I did the three-year program. I did the one-year program that you have to do sort of post-grad to qualify as a lawyer. I got offered a job at one of the city law firms, but I decided that in the end it wasn't really for me, and that actually being in the media was going to be a better course for me to take.
Is the BA level pretty broad in its orientation?
Yeah, the BA level is much more general. Yeah, it's much more general. It's you take modules in kind of all the basic principles of English and European law. So criminal law, a bit of contract law, a bit of sort of the theory of law and jurisprudence, administrative and constitutional law. And of course, everybody now has to do big modules on European law because so much of our sort of sovereignty in a lot of those areas is ceded to Europe.
And then you take two exams.
No, so all the entire, we do 3 years worth of study, and then the entire grade for your university course, whether you get, you know, a 2-1 or a first or whatever, is decided by 9 3-hour exams that you take in the space of a week at the end of your third year.
How fun.
In some ways, you might also say it's slightly sadistic. The amount of revision you do, you know, in the months leading up to those 9 3-hour exams is insane. You know, a lot of other courses have elements of coursework as you go through, or, you know, you get exams at the end of each term. But no, for law, it's just all 27 hours of exams in a week.
Now, do you know the questions ahead of time?
No. It's all sight unseen.
Just anything they want to ask you.
And you can't bring in any textbooks, any notes, anything. You have to just know everything.
So why did you decide on law?
So the reason I decided on law was because originally, you know, I took a module in law in high school, which I thought was quite fun. And so I thought, actually, I could see myself doing this as a job. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed doing it at university. And I think one of the reasons I really enjoyed it was because we got to debate and to sort of investigate and write about a lot of the theory of law and why law is as it is. And you get to argue the points and, you know, try and argue alternative viewpoints. And I really enjoyed that from a kind of theoretical point of view. What I discovered when I did the kind of 1 year, the sort of postgrad course to train you to be a lawyer, is that being a lawyer isn't really like that at all. Nobody really cares what you think about the law or why it is, how it is. They just care whether you can fill out the form to sell one piece of land to somebody else, or whether you can write a 20-page contract to sell one company to somebody else and the caveats and the warranties that entails. And so, you know, I think the practice of being a lawyer is kind of more boring in most areas than the kind of study of it.
In your family growing up, what were your parents' occupations?
So my mother was a teacher, a primary school teacher, and my father was a telecommunications engineer. So he worked for British Telecom, the sort of big national state phone service, fixing problems in the big kind of telephone exchanges that sort of run across the country. And that was kind of where I got my my love of computing, I suppose, was from my dad, who was very into telecommunications, into computers. And he got me my first computer when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6, which was a BBC B, which I don't even know if those existed in the States. It was kind of a forerunner to the Spectrum, I suppose. So that was quite an early one, and that was where I sort of coded my first Hello World routine.
This would have been, late 80s?
Yeah, so I would have been 6 in 88, so yeah.
So what was it like growing up?
I would say it's, I mean, obviously the experience changes drastically. I came from a pretty resolutely middle-class family in a pretty resolutely middle-class area of the world. And so I say I had a pretty decent upbringing. I enjoyed school. I worked pretty hard. You know, my mum being a teacher, you know, taught me to work pretty hard at my academic work. You know, I think the good thing about England, in the most parts, is that it's pretty easy to get green space, so you can always play outside with people, which I guess isn't the case in a lot of, you know, inner city areas, particularly in the States. I would say I had a pretty good time growing up, and my parents were pretty keen on making me try different things. So I tried all sorts of childhood sort of pursuits, from horse riding to karate to playing football, playing cricket, playing the piano, playing guitar. And as I, you know, I sort of tried a lot of things when I was younger and kind of kept a few on as I went sort of older and older. So not many people know that I trained a sort of a qualified orchestral percussionist, which is something that a lot of people can say.
Did you do timpanis?
Yes, absolutely. That was my favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I used to play a lot of sort of concerts at school, and they would always sort of end with Land of Hope and Glory or something like that, which had fantastic timpani parts.
Always the best part of being a drummer.
Yes, absolutely.
Now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
So I guess what constitutes family is my parents, who are still living back in Herefordshire, enjoying a very nice middle class retirement, and my wife, Alex, whom I got married to about 2.5 years ago. We met at Oxford. She was reading English, and we hit it off immediately when we met in a pub, a very typical Oxford pub, and we kind of stayed together ever since. She's an academic now in Oxford.
Academic in English?
Yeah. She has a very particular area, which is medieval English religious texts between sort of 1400 and 1500. And so I maintain that I am kind of the second most educated scholar in England about this, purely with secondhand knowledge.
Sounds like Narnia.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's very interesting.
So what exactly do you do?
So now, it's probably best to give a little bit of background. When I was at university, I started as a hobby writing for sort of computer magazines over here. You know, I had an interest in computers all the way through my youth, and I sort of wanted to keep that up while I was at university. And so I started writing for various computer magazines. I wrote for the BBC and things like that online. And when I left university and went on to read law, I really missed that. And I really missed the journalism aspect of it. And I really missed the technology aspect of it. And so when I decided to not become a lawyer, what I decided to do instead was to set up my own online blog about computers with a couple of friends, with the idea being that we would write a sort of the equivalent of a magazine, but about computing and technology and these kind of things with a particularly UK focus. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did. And we did it kind of out of our bedrooms for 12 months. And then we managed to find somebody who thought we had something good enough to put a little bit of money into it. We got some investment, got a proper office, hired some writing staff, hired some advertising salespeople. And over the next 2 years, that really developed into something quite exciting. The site was called BitTech, which if you Google is still around and still going strong. And yeah, we made it into kind of the leading publication in its sector in the UK over those kind of 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And it got sold to a company called Dennis Publishing, which is a big magazine publishing company over here that publishes things like Maxim and The Week and a number of other technology magazines. So having done that, I wanted to do something else in online media. This was kind of 2007. And in 2007, online video was starting to get really exciting because Google had just bought YouTube, and it was starting to become clear that, you know, YouTube wasn't just a flash in the pan, that this kind of user-generated video wasn't going to be something that was gone in 6 months or so, that it was really a medium which was here to stay. And I was quite excited about video, and so I decided that the next thing that I wanted to do was going to be in that area. And what I sat down and over a period of months brainstormed a number of ideas and did sort of research into various different things. And what I realized was that I thought that whilst online video was going to be a medium that was here to stay, and that short form video, you know, sort of things that are less than 5 minutes, would particularly be exciting given the rise of YouTube and mobile devices and things like that, that most of the user-generated content that was on the web, you know, the sort of typical dogs on skateboards that everybody kind of knows YouTube for, that kind of content wasn't going to be the future of this medium because it was going to be a medium that was sustained by advertising, and I knew that advertisers wouldn't want to be next to that kind of user-generated content. One of the things we learned very early with BitTech was that we had to appear very professional. The presentation of what we did and the quality of the writing had to be very professional to persuade high-quality advertisers to spend big bucks advertising next to it. So I came up with this idea for what became Channel Flip, which was short form content that people could watch on YouTube or on mobile devices, but content that was high quality that I knew we'd be able to get advertisers to get behind. And so we started that, a team of three of us in, I guess, the end of 2007. And so that's what I'm still doing now. We're still running that. Channel Flip has gone through many iterations as we sort of tried things that worked and things that didn't work. And today I think we've got a formula that works pretty well for creating online video, for selling advertising around it, and for making sure that people are watching it.
When you started, did you start with gaining audience first and then looking for sponsors, or the other way around?
So, yeah, that's the real chicken and the egg problem, which is that you can start out trying to build something that has an audience, but you end up having no money, and so you run out of money and that gets very expensive. Or you can try and find a sponsor and try and build an audience, but you can sort of say that then you're just building something commercial that doesn't really have any kind of integrity or any viability in the long term. So what we did was we decided, the three of us kind of quite foolish, well, not foolishly, in the kind of youthful way that we were just going to put all our savings into this for 6 months and that we just exist on credit card loans and things like that in a bid to prove what we thought we knew, which was the hypothesis was if we make kind of high, you know, relatively high quality content and we put it online and we make it in an interesting way, people will watch it. If people watch it, then we know we can go and get advertisers for it. So we did that for 6 months. And the hypothesis turned out to be true. People did watch it. We, you know, over those first 6 months, we had, you know, maybe 50 or 75,000 people come and watch, which was great. I would say that the production quality of the things that we were doing wasn't great, wasn't fantastic, but it was still, you know, a level above most of the other stuff on the internet. Mm-hmm. I think what we underestimated was how long it would take advertisers to cotton on to this area of advertising. We thought that, you know, once online video got to the end of 2007, you know, people had a chance to get used to Google owning YouTube, we'd put out this kind of pseudo professional content that we could then go around advertisers and agencies and say, hey, this is the new thing, advertise on it.
Well, of course, they should know these things, right?
Of course. And what we discovered was that agencies and advertisers were very, very, very slow to cotton onto the developments here. They were still fixated on Google marketing and you know, search marketing, and they didn't really get it. And so we realized very quickly that if we were going to survive long enough for advertisers to sort of get their act together, we were going to need to raise some more money because we couldn't exist on credit cards forever. And so we went then and we raised a little bit of money from basically a syndicate of investors in London, who were mostly all kind of really nice chaps who had made their money in the city and were now semi-retired and were doing investments or, you know, working as consultants to hedge funds or similar sort of things. And we found a group of kind of sort of 10 of those, and they each kind of punted 15 grand as a tax write-off. And so we raised about 150K, which in the grand scheme of, you know, technology investments is not a vast amount of money. To us seemed like a fortune at the time, and allowed us to kind of plan to at least still be around in 12 months' time, which was great. And so we then realized we had 12 months to kind of get the product right, make sure that we could up our production values, make sure that we could build and continue to grow our audience. And so that's what we did. We then did that for 12 months. We kind of got into the crazy recession of 2008. And I would argue that by the time we were starting to run out of money in 2009, online video advertising would have been taking off if it wasn't for the fact that nobody was spending money on anything because we were in the middle of the worst recession the world had ever seen. So we very swiftly realized that if we were going to see out the recession and if we were going to still get advertisers to kind of buy into this type of medium, despite the fact we'd gotten better, we'd gotten more professional, we'd gotten bigger audiences, we needed to make sure we could exist without any major advertising revenue for another 12 months. And so we went out and we raised a little bit more money. you know, from mostly the same group of people who sort of said, well, you've done well and we still believe this advertising is coming, so we'll, you know, punt you another 15 grand each. And so we raised a little bit more money, and we continued to build our product and grow, and eventually we got through to sort of, I guess I say, the beginning of 2010, and then it really kicked off. And I want to say that at the beginning of 2010, you know, all the effort that we put into building what we thought was a good product, a good company, all the effort that we put into building an audience started to pay us back, because advertisers finally started to get on board. They finally were hearing enough every week in, you know, the kind of online world about video, said, okay, we need to get into this. Who should we go and talk to? And we were there waiting with open arms for them. and so I'd say that in the last 12 months, the market for online video advertising has really kicked off in the UK. We've been very, you know, well, I'd say we've been very lucky. I'd say we've been very resilient, actually, to be here. Yes. Waiting for it. And now we've got, you know, a great set of problem on our hands, which is that we're now trying to grow fast enough to keep up with the demand.
Well, it seems to me that although your site is international, that advertising must be pretty regional.
Yes. I mean, the advertising world is really interesting because everybody sort of tends to think that the internet is this global thing. And so, you know, the great joy of it is that you can reach all these people internationally without having to sort of think regionally. But it's really interesting to sort of discover that when you actually go and talk to these big global brands, whether it's Coca-Cola or Microsoft or whoever, you know, the number of brands that actually think about their advertising strategy in an international sense, you can probably count on, you know, on one hand. And so we tend to deal very much with you know, the agencies and advertisers who are based in London, and they are only ever concerned with what is happening in the UK and, you know, maybe Europe. Never the US, because I suppose the audiences, the actual people consuming the advertising, consuming the content, are sort of very different, you know, no matter where people are in the world.
What percentage of your customers come from other places than the UK?
UK is about 75% of the people watching Channel Flip, and that's a really high number, obviously because we primarily market to the UK, but also because a lot of the talent, a lot of the TV people that we use are UK people who aren't necessarily known in the States. And so the other 25% is probably 15% States and 10% Australia, actually. Australia has quite a big sort of, obviously, quite a big British humour kind of expat community.
Yes. I love to watch the David Mitchell's soapbox. I don't know that British humour is, maybe I'm just British in my humour.
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of British humour is based on sarcasm and irony. And, you know, the big sort of cultural stereotype is that Americans don't really get irony. I don't think that's actually true, for the record. But, it's certainly true that, for example, the biggest sort of prime time TV star in the UK is a guy called Harry Hill, who produces a sort of very funny comedy show that airs 7 o'clock on a Saturday night on the biggest channel over here. And I don't think anybody in the States has ever heard of him. So I think that's an interesting one.
What was the TV show that was the fake talk show by the Indian family?
Oh, The Kumars at 42.
The Kumars, yes. That was a funny show. That was hilarious.
Yes, it was. It was. I don't know again how well that would translate, but I guess maybe because it's sort of a pastiche of Indian culture, it would probably work equally well anywhere where Indian culture has been exported.
I don't know. Anybody who has a family, I thought it would work well with
Maybe. I mean, I guess the prime example of content like that would be The Office.
Yes.
Where, that was a very, very, very British thing. I think the UK version had some moderate success in the States, but it was really, it's really the US version that's taken off.
Yeah, I actually like the UK version better.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
One of the odd things to me is that when I watch BBC America, is that I don't actually get to watch BBC. They Americanize things when I want to watch what you guys are watching.
Yes, so I think what they're going to do, I mean, that is a problem. The BBC, produces a lot of content that goes all around the world, and a lot of it they try to localise. I think what they're going to do now is open up the iPlayer so that you can play a small subscription charge and get the iPlayer internationally so you can get exactly what UK people are watching at the exact time.
One of the benefits of Channel Flip is I get my British thing with a direct connection.
Yes, exactly. One of the things that we've been really keen to do is really focus on the British side of things. I mean, as I mentioned, as a business, we have to attract advertisers. Being where we are, London and the local UK advertisers are really what we're going for. And for them, they put a premium on UK content, on high quality content. Obviously, a lot of the content being created on the web is being created by people in America, purely because, the number of people that are in America. And so there is a perceived premium, even if in reality there is not an actual premium in terms of user behavior, on UK eyeballs watching UK generated content with UK specified advertising against it. That is kind of the prime thing that we look after. One of the things we are looking to do, and I think this is this really speaks to the regionalization, is we would like to monetize the American people that come and watch our content. But to do that, we would have to go and set up really an audience in an office in New York to go and deal directly with the advertisers there. So, that's quite a significant barrier to going and doing that. Although I'm sure we'll do it at some point in the next 12 months.
How do you market Channel Flip to your audience?
So really, we have found the most effective way of marketing an online product is online. And you can say that is perhaps slightly obvious, but we see, I see a lot of adverts in newspapers, a lot of PR, a lot of effort spent sort of marketing events to try and get people to go online and look at something. And we found that on the whole, marketing offline in newspapers or magazines or anywhere like that is
far more cost inefficient to marketing online. So that's the first sort of obvious thing. The second thing is that we found that social networks like Facebook are absolute gold for marketing to people and for sort of getting the word out about what it is that we do. And the reason, you know, that we can do that is because by default, people tell Facebook so much information about themselves. You know, if they, for the sake of staying up to date with their favorite bands or their favorite TV shows or their favorite, you know, comedians, they put all that data in. They say, I am a fan of Mitchell and Webb, or I am a fan of Harry Hill, or, you know, any of those things. And so we can directly, with advertising, target those people so that we know they're going to get something that is interesting to them. And we know that we are going to be interesting to them. Mm-hmm. I think the people talk about Facebook as having the potential to kind of topple Google as the number one advertiser in the world. And I think that's definitely possible because Google created this fantastic system of having adverts appear alongside search terms so people know directly what you are searching for. And that's obviously a very powerful kind of information mechanic. But you can argue that what Facebook has is even more powerful. It's not just what you're searching for at that given point. It's what you're interested in general and what you might be likely to be more interested in. And so rather than responding to a search query, you can proactively market to somebody, you know, before they necessarily even know that they want it. So I think we have certainly found that Facebook is an incredibly powerful platform for marketing, and so that's where we spend probably the majority of our efforts actually.
What's the best thing about your job?
That's really tricky.
Thank you.
I would say there's two answers to that, really. Two answers. One of the best things about my job on a day-to-day basis is getting to do what I want to do. Because I started, you know, was one of the people starting Channel Flip, I've kind of had the opportunity to carve out the things that I like to do and hire people to do the things that I don't like to do. And so on a daily basis, it's quite satisfying to come into the office and meet with a group of nice people and do the things that you enjoy doing.
Yes.
So for me, the best part of my job is, I my teenage self would slap me now for saying this. I really enjoy financial modeling, and I've had to do a lot of that. You know, sitting in spreadsheets with financial projections and working out where the costs are and where the returns are and gross margins and percentages and all that kind of thing. And it sounds very boring, but I actually find it really interesting. And it's something that I've sort of taught myself over the last couple of years.
How adult of you.
Yeah, well, it is, you know, it does sound very boring, but I actually really enjoy doing that. So I'd say probably, you know, that's the ability to do the things that I find interesting on the one hand is the best part of my job. On the other hand, I would say that as the creator of a company, the thing that I find perhaps the most gratifying rather than the most enjoyable is to have the opportunity to employ people, to hire people and see them grow, to see them form their own teams, to see them kind of interacting with each other. Basically, the ability to put together a group of people and help them to achieve something. You know, I feel very much that my job is to facilitate what they do in many senses. And as somebody who we started Channel Flip with two people, we're now at 20 people. And it's it's really, really gratifying in quite a visceral way to see this happening all around you and to feel like you've really created that. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, you know, that's certainly probably the most enjoyable part of my job. A really good way of explaining that would be that we had, maybe when we got to like 9 or 10 people and it was just starting to feel like it was taking off. And somebody organized a birthday event One of the members of staff organized a birthday event for one of the other members of staff without me ever having been involved in it. And it was the first thing, it was the first time I think that anything had happened at Channel Flip without me being directly involved in it. And it sort of felt like, wow, it's now taking on a life of its own.
Yes.
And that does feel incredibly, it's just such a nice feeling to feel like something is taking off and becoming something that's independent of you.
Mm-hmm. What has surprised you?
What has surprised me? I feel like I'm constantly surprised because constantly things work that I didn't think had a hope in hell of working and things don't work that I thought were surefire. I suppose the thing that surprised me is how little I know, or how little any of us know, actually. The media industry has been in a real state of turmoil for almost the past decade, really. And it's still not settled down. And I think what has surprised me was that I really thought that by this point in time, we'd have some really firm business models, some really firm media dynamics and audience consumption kind of models, and we'd know how all this stuff was going to work over the next 10 years. We'd have figured it out. And I think what surprised me is that still today we kind of have no idea what the future of media is going to be. You know, the newspapers are fiddling around with subscription models and iPads and tablets. You know, smartphones have come out of nowhere. I mean, it's only, 4 years ago now that the iPhone launched.
Mm-hmm.
And how the world has changed in that 4 years. And so I think what surprised me is that nothing is still settled. Everything is still up for grabs. And nobody really knows how and when or if media will change and evolve over the next decade.
It seems to me that fame is sort of a level or circle kind of phenomena. What level of fame are you at?
I'd say I have a very low level of specialized fame. In fact, you know, I say that there are lots of different levels of fame. I'd say you can very accurately quantify them based on Twitter followings.
Yes.
In a way, you know, Twitter is the absolute arbiter of fame. I would say that I've got about just over 20,000 followers on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's, I say that makes me a kind of E-list. I'm an E or F celebrity in that sense. I think if you're over 1 million, you can qualify as A-list definitively. Over 100,000, I think you could probably get on the B list, and then it gets, stratified below that. You know, it's interesting. I've had the fortune of you know, writing and you know in a public forum for a living for many years, and now you know I do sort of guest appearances on various podcasts and things like that, and that sort of helped keep my profile up. It's certainly gratifying when some of my friends look me up for the first time on Twitter and say, "Oh my God, you've got 20,000 followers! You're amazing." It's certainly better than average, more fame than average. I have had, in fact, you know, the funniest thing about fame is that it creeps up on you in the most unlikely places. And I'd say probably 3 or 4 occasions now, I've been stopped in the street or stopped while I'm sat at a coffee shop and somebody said, "Oh, wow, you're Will Harris." The funniest thing about that is that it always seems to happen when I'm sat next to somebody that I'm trying to impress. And it's amazing timing. But nobody ever believes me when I tell them I didn't set that up. Seriously. So, you know, whenever somebody recognizes you like that, you just get a little glow, which is great.
That's funny. I got some more questions for Will, but let me take a moment to introduce you to a disorder that impacts a lot of people. In the UK, it's called ME, myalgic encephalopathy. In the US, it's called CFIDS, chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome. Whatever you call it, it's a chronic neurological disease of unknown cause and no known cure. Most every body system is impacted, including the musculovascular, immune, and central nervous systems. Symptoms include problems with vision, balance, coordination, pain, and sensitivity to cold, sound, and visceral stimulation. It screws up mitochondrial production and cellular metabolism and replication. For many, it's a totally disabling condition, and even for those patients who get better, it's a relapsing, remitting disease. Although it can occur at any age, it's mostly found in women in their 20s and 30s. My daughter has been sick with this condition since her junior year in college. This is a disorder that really needs more research. So go to cfids.org and donate. CFIDS.org. Thanks. Well, everybody needs to give themselves self-motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Oh, I can honestly say that self-motivation is probably the issue that most entrepreneurs struggle with more than any other. And I certainly can attest to that. When you're running a company or when you've started a company, particularly when you've started a company, there is really nobody who knows what it is like to do that apart from somebody else that's been through that experience. And so getting motivated is very hard because unless you're surrounded by people who have started their own companies, you can't talk to anybody, you can't explain to anybody, you can't bounce ideas off anybody. And consequently, it's very easy to just get lost in your own head and really feel the motivation sapping away from you quickly. Mm-hmm. Because you sort of get the feeling that nobody really understands what you're going through. So what I do when I really want to sort of feel that that kick in the pants is go and read. I mean, this sounds really geeky, but I go and read blogs. And I go and try and seek out people who have had the same problems that I have had. And I go and try and sort of absorb some of their knowledge and try and internalize that and apply it to my own situation. I found a number of great bloggers who write about the problems with starting companies and how to do that. People like Mark Andreessen, who's a very famous venture capitalist. People like Jason Calacanis, who's been a very successful entrepreneur. They write very useful and very insightful blogs, you know, more like books when you actually take their blog as a whole, about starting companies, running companies, the internet, you know, sector in general, business psychology and things like that. And I find that sort of just going through and reading some of those can often really give me a boost. I think the other thing that really helps me get motivated, I would say, is going to the gym. There's nothing like, you know, sort of pounding a treadmill and getting a blast of adrenaline and to really make you feel a little bit better, even if only for the sort of half an hour when you're off and your pulse is racing, you're feeling really good. Sometimes that can just be enough to just sort of spark an idea or really get you going again.
Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
That's much easier because I have to do that all the time. I think the number one problem probably that every person, you know, sort of running a business faces is that thing of lying awake at night and you've got all these things running through your head, whether it's worries or stresses or exciting ideas. A couple of things that I do to de-stress myself. I'm a big advocate of the brain dump, where I'll just take a piece of paper or take my laptop and just spend half an hour just typing everything that's in my head and every idea that I have and just try and get it all out of my head and onto paper so that I can stop my brain going round and round and round and I can get it to focus on something else. That's a very useful technique. Music is a great way to sort of calm myself down. And sometimes I'll, you know, in the evenings, just put on some really nice, doesn't even have to be soothing music, but just something that will just switch your brain into a different gear. I think the third thing that I find really de-stresses me is listening to podcasts, listening to audiobooks, because it's something that your brain starts to take in and starts to switch from work mode into a different kind of thing. The number of times I've sort of fallen asleep listening to podcasts because, you know, my brain has been stuck in work and I've switched on, you know, some kind of technology podcast and my brain switches into technology and then it starts to slow down a bit. And as soon as it starts to slow down, that's it. You know, the physical tire kicks in and I'm off to sleep. So I think all of those things, you know, de-stressing is all about switching your brain from work mode into some other kind of mode. So anything that helps you make that mental transition is always good.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
That's really tough. Is there? Yes, is definitely the answer, but there's probably too many.
Well, yes would be the shortest answer I've ever gotten.
Yes. I mean, I suppose the event that challenged me to the core was when we were sort of maybe 6 months into Channel Flip. And we were really struggling to get investment because, you know, the financial environment was starting to topple. And we kind of got to the point where we'd really run out of the sort of comfortable amount of money that we'd put away to fund it. And we, I remember really clearly, we finished work one day, myself and Justin, and we went and sat in the pub and we just said, are we going to kill this now or are we going to try and find a way to carry it on? And we sat for a good couple of hours weighing up the pros and cons of what to do, because we'd run out of money. We were gonna have to try and find more money from somewhere. We weren't sure that it was really going to take. That was a really, really, really challenging moment to sort of look defeat in the eye and try and say, I don't feel beaten yet. I might feel beaten again in a couple of months' time, but not yet. I'm going to try and turn it around. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that was incredibly challenging, yeah.
If you were giving a commencement address, a graduation address, giving your best advice, what would you say?
The best advice in the world I can give is to find a job that you love doing, because then work won't be a chore. I think... genuinely, there are so many people that work, you know, 9-to-5 jobs and they don't enjoy what they do, or they just do it for the paycheck, or they do it, you know, because they think it's what they should be doing, it's what they train to do, or they can't afford to live on anything less than what, you know, it is they're doing. I honestly think that if you can find something that you enjoy doing, it just changes your quality of life enormously, because work doesn't become a chore. It doesn't become something you have to do. It doesn't become something that occupies this huge block of time where you could be doing something else. It's something that you genuinely enjoy. You can come into the office every morning or whatever it is you work and do something fun. And that honestly completely changes your perspective on life if you can do that. Don't just take a paycheck. Do something you genuinely want to do.
The last question is to help me get better at this process. Think of a defining moment in your life that we didn't talk about. What question should I have asked to get you to tell me that story?
Defining moment in my life, and what should you have asked? Perhaps what moment in your upbringing most contributed to the person that you are today?
So, Will, what moment in your upbringing contributed the most to what you are today?
I can tell you that immediately, which was a fight that I had in the playground of my primary school when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And when I was at primary school, I was bullied pretty badly, both for being kind of more intelligent and, you know, the brainy, geeky, swotty kid, and also for being a bit fat and wearing glasses. You know, I was that typical person. And I kind of sucked it up. There was one kid in the school in particular who was just a real pain. And one day I just felt like I'd had enough, and I just smacked the guy in the playground, and we just got into a massive fight. And, you know, the teacher had to come and break us up, and all these things happened. And I got hauled in front of the headmaster, and the headmaster was a really nice guy, and he knew how hard I worked and how, you know, and how enthusiastic I was about school. And this, he said to the other kid, good Lord, what have you done to make Will so angry? Will's such a nice guy. He wouldn't hit anybody unless they deserved it. And that taught me two things, really. It taught me never to bully anybody, because I think you can always tell in adulthood the kids who were bullies and the kids who were bullied. And the kids who are bullied are always the nicer people because they understand what it's like to be the outsider, and they're always more inclusive, and they're always more thoughtful about other people's feelings. And so that was the first thing I took away, was to always try and be kind to other people and never try and bully anybody. The second thing I learned from that was that sometimes fighting back is justified. And sometimes, you can take it, you can soak it up, and you can take abuse, and you can try and keep things from getting out of hand. But sometimes you've just got to flip the lid and let something kick off, because in the end, everyone would be better off for it.
I want to thank Will Harris for joining me. Thanks, Will. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.